Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, I'm Zivi Owens, and I am the host of this podcast, Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. I am also a newly minted USA Today bestselling author of the novel Blank. I've created a whole community of book lovers around this podcast, a publishing company, reading retreats, a bookstore, and more. Learn more at zivimedia.com or follow me on social at Zivi Owens or join the community at Zivi Readers. Lisa Soap is the author of Other People's Words, Friendship Loss, and the Conversations That Never End. Lisa is a senior editor for audio at Vox Media and special projects producer and senior scholar in residence at YR Media. She has a PhD from Stanford, where she studied education, social theory, and linguistic anthropology with leading Bakhtin scholars. She lives in San Francisco.
Welcome, Lisa. Thank you so much for coming on Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books to discuss Other People's Words, Friendship Loss, and the Conversations That Never End.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Oh, thrilled to have you. Can you tell listeners a little bit about this book, why you wrote this book, the losses that inspired it, the intellectual thoughts that you wove throughout? Just tell me about the structure, and all of it, so people have a sense, please.
Absolutely. Yes. So Other People's Words started when two friends of mine died around the same time, about 10 years ago, in very different ways. So Christine died slowly after a long and deceptive illness that did a lot of damage to her mind and to her relationships before she finally got a diagnosis and it ultimately ended her life. Johnny died suddenly, all at once. He was swimming in a lake in Montana and a boat ran over him and he didn't survive. So the book is a story of these friendships, these loves, and these losses. And it's really also a story about friendship itself as a great love in our lives that often doesn't get the same recognition as other intimacies that define us. And I know this is something that you have written and thought a lot about as well. And it's about what it feels like to have lost these friends for me, and then to have found them again and again through language. So the sort of shape-shifting power of language in the face of loss is a through line in the book. And one of the things that sort of drove me to write it, as I started to notice all the ways that I and others who were left behind by these two amazing people, how we were using language to hold loved ones close, even after they were gone, in this particular way, by sort of experiencing and carrying their voices within our own, you know, the phrases, the intonations, the ways with words that sort of define the people we love. They don't go away when somebody's gone, right? And one of the ways that they stay with us is we hold them in our own voices. And I started to notice that in myself. And I hope that the book is an invitation for readers to notice their own loves and losses and their own uses of language and the people that are with them in their words, right? Because our language is teeming with voices, you know, real voices, imagined voices, remembered voices, present voices, voices we long for, maybe voices we wish weren't so palpable in our own language. And so when you start to notice that in a time of loss, it gave me a kind of companionship and a through line to people whose conversations I wasn't ready to live without. And then you start noticing it in other ways too, right? Not only in loss. So it becomes a really expansive sort of like revelation for me. And therefore I hope that that readers will be able to see themselves in these stories and see their own stories and hear their own words in a different way.
Wow. Well, you definitely accomplished all of that. I am so sorry for your losses. Can we talk about your friends for just a moment? Because you really introduce us to both of them. And Johnny, for instance, first of all, the way in which he died was so horrible that he was there basically at the lake because of his father-in-law's recent passing, stepfather-in-law's recent passing, and they were all gathered and he just like ran. I mean, oh my gosh, and his whole family right on the shore and how sudden it was. Anyway, so terrible. And you talk about how you as couples kind of grew up together and what he was like. And then the moment when his brother came to the memorial and he spoke the same way, which kind of gave me chills. So just paint a little picture of Johnny, who in my head is like this, you know, he used to have long red hair, right? Like I'm trying to like conjure him myself, but just so other people get a visual.
Yeah. One of the things that I say in the book is that a lot of people become larger in life after they're gone, but Johnny was kind of larger than life when he was still alive. He was beloved, and first and foremost, well, by his family and by the person through whom I met him, Emily, his wife and his two children. And he had the most like far-flung crew of people who loved him because he didn't sweat the usual sort of categories that many of us get caught up in especially when we're young and trying to figure out who we are. Johnny was everything that he wanted to be. So sometimes that meant an anarchist who was climbing at the top of a crane when he was in college to protest. I think that one was around weapons, you know, outside of Operation Rescue, you know, fighting for women's reproductive rights with his long red hair and, you know, goofy sense of style. And then he got an MBA and, you know, worked in real estate. And, you know, he was kind of an iconoclast with a huge heart, you know, a huge heart, like a sense of humor and fearlessness. But inside, it was like just this warm, loving, expressive soul. And, you know, and that came through to his family members, to the way he was a parent and the way he was a partner to Emily and the way he was a friend to so many of us who continue to gather every year. On his birthday, we get together at a restaurant in Oakland. And I think that's just an indication of who he collected around him. We're all such different people, but we all feel so close to Johnny's spirit and Johnny's memory.
Oh, what was his birthday?
When was his birthday? It was, oh my God, you're really asking me that. I always have to, I don't remember.
Okay, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Don't worry. I don't even know why I asked you. So forget it. Random question. Okay, so then we go to Christine, and I'm so sorry for everything that happened there. And you obviously were such a source of solace for Emily and kids and everything. So Christine, you met as a student and a teacher, and you had like a little crush on her yourself. And like
had the crush on Mercy.
You had the crush on Mercy. That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. That's absolutely right. No. You had the crush on Mercy. Mercy was with Christine already. Anyway, wasn't that sort of hard? Because then you and your husband end up like befriending them so closely, and you were always kind of wondering what the alternate life would have been like had you been the one who ended up with Mercy.
You know what? I mean, it's so interesting. No, it wasn't hard. It was just rich. Like, that's how I remember it. It was just a rich time in our lives, you know. So Mercy and I met in a grad school class, and she was across the room, and she was kind of like Johnny, kind of like smart and fearless and said what was on her mind. And she just, you know, I was drawn to her. curious about her, found my way to sit next to her and start talking to her and hanging out outside of class. And, you know, just the thing that happens when you kind of fall for somebody in all the various ways, you know, and that rush of when it starts to feel like, oh, we're going to become important to each other in some way. And you allow yourself, maybe especially when you're young, to kind of imagine all the different ways that that could go. And then pretty soon in my, as that was evolving with Mercy, she told me about Christine. And Christine was her partner whom she'd met back at the school where they taught on the East Coast. Christine was 20 years older than we were. And so she had this sort of mystery to her that she, like, who is this older woman? And what's it going to be like to spend time with her? And so we got together for the first time at this bar, the right spot in the Mission. It was my birthday, I think, is how it all started. And, you know, I mean, I just believe friendships operate on lots of different levels in relationships. You know, things are spoken and unspoken, and intimacies, you know, operate on lots of levels, and not everything has to be said out loud. And I feel like that's how we get close to each other. And so, like I talked about the shape-shifting power of language, I guess there's a shape-shifting reality to our relationships too. So once I met Christine and I truthfully, I mean, I remember this feeling, kind of beheld the love that they had and how real and deep it was and how like, kind of like out of my league I was projecting myself in any way in that world because there was so much between them. And there was so much between me and my husband too. You know, it was like, he wasn't my husband at the time. He was my boyfriend. It just rearranged itself in a very, as I said, like a meaningful way. You know, I'm sure there were complications, but there was also discoveries of closeness. And we all became like the way that sometimes can happen. And Christine talked about this when she married us, you know, we were two couples that could rearrange ourselves in every possible combination. There was always something that connected us, which is part of what made it so devastating for all of us when initially the relationship between Mercy and Christine started to fall apart, and we had to experience that loss before we experienced the loss of when Christine actually passed away.
I feel like in both of these situations, it's like, you know, a table with four legs and one of them has been you know, kicked out, and you all go toppling in both situations because it was such a part of such a strong, you know, quadrupled thing. You know what I mean?
Anyway, yeah, I do.
Your thoughts about language too. I mean, it got me thinking about how as soon as somebody passes away, like the first thing I do is try to like get a record of what I have, right? How many handwritten cards do I have, a voicemail? What are the emails? Like, what is the record of the words that we've exchanged over time? And it's like, there's that instinct to preserve whatever you can. And often words are what is left the longest. So speak to that for a minute.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad you're bringing that up. And because you asked about the kind of intellectual through line in the book, and I didn't mention there's actually sort of a presiding spirit over the book, this philosopher of language, Mikhail Bakhtin, whom I studied actually with Mercy in graduate school. Like we kind of met Bakhtin together, but Bakhtin was by that point dead. He died in 1975. He's a Russian philosopher of language. If you were like in college or grad school at a particular time in the US, you know, around in the 90s, you know, when you were studying humanities or literature, or even social science, you might have stumbled across some of Bakhtin's ideas. He was kind of having a heyday at that time. And when I encountered his ideas about language, even at the time before I had experienced these losses, I knew there was something in his ideas that for me hit very close to home. It was more than just this kind of academic exercise. And it came down to this line that I ended up, you know, kind of lifting for the title of the books. So Bakhtin had this idea that our speech is filled to overflowing with other people's words. This idea that, you know, dialogue, yes, it exists in the conversation you and I are having between us. But what Bakhtin would say is dialogue actually exists inside my own voice, inside your voice, inside everybody's voice. There's this rippling of conversation that is happening in how our words, how we received our words, because we didn't get them from a dictionary, right? We got them from our relationships, from what's been said before. And then everything that we add through our own speech is just flowing out into the world for others to pick up and use. So when you talk about cherishing what's left behind in the voices or the writing or the emails or the text messages of people who are gone, you know, Bakhtin is just a window for me into sort of understanding and listening for those vibrations, right? So that when I pick up a letter, and the thing is, Christine in particular was just constantly writing. She was old fashioned in that way. So when long beyond past, when most of us had converted to digital, she and Mercy both would just write us handwritten letters. So every drawer in my house, you know, still I'll open a drawer and there's a postcard from Christine. Or so there are just like kind of relics and artifacts of her handwriting. And then when she did finally move to emails and text messages and just some of the ways as her illness came over her, her writing changed in ways that were, could be quite devastating. And also Christine was a poet and loved poetry. And there was also poetry in this new voice that I encountered, full of, you know, lines of periods and exclamation points and question marks and just a fragmented kind of way of finding language and just holding on to language for dear life is what it kind of felt like towards the end for Christine. And so all of that material is kind of the story of her life, our friendship, her will to keep connecting, keep expressing, keep really loving Mercy and loving us all. And it was, it, so it's powerful to be able to hold on to and live with those elements that are left behind.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Sometimes we all have stuff we need to get off our chests. Even if we don't think it's interfering with our daily life, there are some things you just haven't processed, be it grief or trauma, eating disorders, anything. It might be time to work on those things, and I have a solution for you. Therapy. Online therapy by BetterHelp. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. I took the brief questionnaire online where there were, I don't know, 20 questions. It didn't take long at all, maybe 3 minutes. And then I got matched with a therapist who could help me work on whatever. I picked trauma because even though it happened in 2001, I am somehow still not over the loss of my friend on 9/11. And it is what it is. BetterHelp is going to help. And I am so excited, especially because with my special code, instead of $80 a month, it is 10% off, $72 a month, which is so much less than traditional therapy. And you'll get a perfect therapist for you. There are 35,000 therapists to choose from, so you'll find the right one. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/momsdonthavetime today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/momsdonthavetime.
Did you see the movie Still Alice with Julianne Moore?
Yes.
I think about that all the time, how at the end, as a linguistics professor, all that was left was the word love.
Yeah.
And how she just, oh my gosh, it was like just so, I can never stop thinking about it. And in
thought on that, it's just interesting that you bring that up because on the flight home from, I think it was after visiting Christine, I watched that movie. And I don't know if you remember the song that it ends with is this song originally by Lyle Lovett called If I Had a Boat. And it turns out that that song was really meaningful to Mercy and Christine. And so at Christine's memorial service. There was a formal memorial service at school where Christine and Mercy taught. And then Mercy had people at her house afterwards, and there was a bonfire. And one of Christine's students was a member of the Fugees. And he came to the, John Forte, his name is, and he came to the memorial service, and we're all sitting around this bonfire, and he takes out his guitar and he sang that song. And it was just this layering, right? I mean, that's part of what these stories that are out in the world that aren't even our own stories, like that movie, right? Layer into our stories and become part of, you know, how we live with loss and repair, you know, repair and feel close to the people we're missing.
Oh my gosh. Well, I mentioned at the beginning that I've already recommended your book to a bunch of people, which is true, because this notion of conversation even with those that have passed away is so interesting. And you open the book with this phone booth in Tokyo where you can communicate. You just open this wind, you called it like a wind tunnel, isn't wind something, wind channel, I don't know. And that you can talk to, you just get the spirits in and you can like talk to the people who you've lost. Yeah. And this girlfriend of mine said that after her mother had died, she actually feels almost closer to her, that she was so anxious about it for so long. But she feels her around her all the time now, and that she still has conversations with her, even though it sounds very like woo-woo. But she feels this like warmth and you know, sense of being taken care of and in conversation with her mother who's already passed away. So anyway, I recommended her your book.
So much. Yeah, that image is from, so Mickey Meek is a radio journalist and told the story of the wind telephone on This American Life. I recommend it to anybody to listen to that piece, which is where I first learned about the wind telephone. And it was established by a man who actually had lost a cousin and was not ready for those conversations with his cousin to end. So he got a hold of an old-fashioned phone booth with a, you know, big black rotary phone in it. And he set it up in his garden. He lived on the coast of Japan in like a sea farming town. And then a tsunami hit in 2011, and suddenly people who were grieving loved ones they'd lost started coming to his wind telephone. And the other thing that started to happen as years went by is people built wind telephones in other places. So when the ghost ship fire happened in Oakland, California, I don't know if people are familiar with a terrible fire that killed many young artists in Oakland, there was a wind telephone built there. So people are using that image to do exactly what you're describing and what your friend has found, which is we need vessels, places where, whether it's in our own imaginations or in actual buildings or spaces, where we allow ourselves those kind of magical, realist conversations and allow those voices to flow and to hear who we need to hear from and to say what we need to say.
Absolutely. I feel like I need a wind telephone.
Yeah.
I feel like we all need a wind telephone.
Don't we all? Don't we all?
You have such a beautiful quote in here, although this might be from Stegner, but I'm not sure. You said, "There it was, there it is, the place where during the best of our lives, friendship had its home and happiness its headquarters."
That is Stegner.
That is Stegner. Okay.
But look, other people's words, right? I mean, that's the thing about writing this book. It's all very meta, right? Because like this, even the act of citation becomes like something to think about, right? I love that. I love that idea of happiness having headquarters.
Gorgeous. Do you feel more at, I mean, that sounds so hokey. Do you feel at peace? But what, let me ask it a different way. What did writing the book do for you emotionally?
You know, the process of writing this book was unlike any kind of creative process I've ever had before. I mean, partly because like I've written academic work and then I also work in audio. You know, I make a lot of radio and podcasts. So they're two very different ways of telling stories. And this was singular in my life. I had not ever done anything so personal. There's a kind of like devotion in it because I feel devoted not only to the memories of Christine and Johnny, but to Mercy and to Emily and to their families and to the, you know, the great love and loss that I experienced and witnessed in those who were closest to, you know, to these figures in my life and in their lives. So it felt like a practice. I can't really explain. It was like, I just felt like called to do it a lot as opposed to assigned or required or like, and truthfully, it took a long time to get a home for this book. I'm so grateful forever and ever to Spiegel and Growl and to Tina Bennett, my agent, because it was not an easy book to kind of land somewhere. And so I experienced a lot of, you know, rejection and like uncertainty, like, is this thing ever going to go out into the world? And I felt a lot of responsibility because Mercy and Emily and others had been so generous and trusting with me to allow me to tell the story this way and to share their story. So I felt like, oh my God, what if it doesn't happen? But all the while, I just kept thinking, you know what, if this is the manuscript that is like printed out in my desk drawer when I die and never landed anywhere, and I'm still, I will not regret a minute that I spent working on it. I really felt that way, you know, like, of course, I'm sure I would have been like shattered and like taken to my bed if it never, and I did a couple times, but I still feel like, I don't know, like it was a window and an opening to like think about all the things I wanted to think about and feel the things I wanted to feel and find language that would do justice to like the real stuff of life. Like that's what, not to sound self-important, that maybe does, but that's kind of what it doesn't, that's what it felt like to write it.
It doesn't sound self-important. And part of why you wanted to publish is for other people. So there you go.
Yeah.
And how was the experience with Spiegel and Growl? And by the way, I love the stuff they publish. So,
oh my God, it's so good. So honestly, good. It's so good. And, you know, I've written academic books before. So I've worked with university presses. And then, as I said, I've done a ton of like radio and podcasting with Youth Radio, YR Media, but I had never done a book like this with a real, with a, you know, trade press in New York. So I don't know what to compare it to, but people have said to me, like, dude, you have no idea. Like, it's not usually like this. I mean, they just take such care. They have taken such care with this book and supporting me in the process. And really, yeah, I think they very intentionally, the reason they set up shop the way they did is so that they wouldn't be just churning, you know, They could like really put focus on the books that they were getting behind. And I really had felt that.
Amazing. Are you thinking of writing anything else now that you're?
Oh, always, you know. I mean, I do have some ideas. I mean, one of the things before I get to, I do have a little idea like in the back of my head that started actually as maybe a podcast idea. It's like a narrative podcast idea, but thinking about, you know, what that might evolve into. Before I get there, though, interestingly, you know, I'm working on the audiobook for Other People's Words, which is itself a really, you know, a creative process for me because I work in audio and I'm so, so interested in how we tell stories across different media, in particular, as more and more people experience books through the ear. And I've heard that from my friends who are writers, that it used to be when they would go on tour and everybody would come and tell them about what it was like to read their book. And now very often the conversation is when I listen to your book, like it's changed, you know, like, yep. And authors have to, you know, relate to their audiobooks differently. So for me, as somebody who's always thinking about that in my regular life, to really imagine how can I represent in audio the change in Christine's words when so much of it is like typographical and you see it on the page, but how do you hear it? You know, we're thinking about Johnny's voice and Johnny's voicemails to Emily. And, you know, that's one of the other things that are left behind, you know, that come alive on the page. And how do you hear those things? So that's a creative project that is kind of extension of Other People's Words, but still feels in some ways like its own project that lies ahead.
Oh, I love that. Well, that's going to be great. Yeah, I recorded audiobooks for my past books and my memoir, but now I have this novel coming out and someone else is doing it. And I'm like, are you sure you don't want me to do it?
Do you have any advice?
Not that I'm a narrator, but, you know, at least I kind of know the voices in my head of who these people are, even though I created them. But anyway, any advice? When I did my audiobook for my children's book, which is only like 10 pages, it's like ridiculous that there even is an audiobook, but I had a cold. And I had like really bad allergies. I always am all congested. Anyway, they made me like put my face in a pot of hot water, like between every mistake. And I was just like, oh my gosh, how has my life come to this? That I'm like reading this children's book with my face in a bowl of water. And anyway, so I would say, you know, try not to be sick and bring some cough drops or something. I don't know.
Okay, good advice. Maybe reschedule. I'm thinking maybe reschedule if I've.
No, 100%. Okay, quickly, parting advice for aspiring authors.
Oh my gosh. Okay, let me think. Be in community. And that's what I have a beloved friend, Nicole Fleetwood, who's a genius writer. And we've kind of held each other through the process of sort of navigating in and out of, we met in grad school and in and out of like academic and then other ways of telling stories. And when I hit a point with other people's words where I was feeling a little at sea, she was like, do a workshop, get with other people, find, you know, unique community engaging with this work. And I always had that in other ways, but it's like taking moments of being really intentional about that. I have writing, incredible writing groups that this would not exist without. But I guess there are times where instead of going into the isolation of moments of feeling like you don't know what you're doing, see if you can like reach out and find others who are kind of on this journey in their own ways and can help shore up what you need to do to keep going.
I love that. Well, congratulations on exchanging a few words with me about other people's words. Good luck with the audiobook. Congrats on the launch. And
thank you for your writing on friendship and loss. And, you know, I'm moved by what you've said about and written about your friendship and how you've lived with it over all these years now that she's gone. So I appreciate that we're together in trying to make sense of in those friendships and losses.
Maybe they're all hanging out together now. Mm-hmm. These larger than life characters.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Lissa. Great to meet you.
Thank you so much. You too.
Okay. Have a great day.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. If you love it, please leave a review and follow us on social at Zibby Owens and at Zibby Readers.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.